I remember standing in my kitchen cooking dinner for my son, and I suddenly just burst out laughing. You know, it was just this suddenly this joyful thought of, isn't it crazy that nature has come up with this incredible little machine?
The history of science is full of accidental discoveries. Penicillin, perhaps most famously, but also gunpowder and nuclear fission. It makes sense, doesn't it? Because you don't know what you don't know. You don't always know what you're looking for or at. Sometimes you've just got a curious mind.
So the research project that led to this technology was really a curiosity-driven project.
Jennifer Doudna is a professor of chemistry and biology at the University of California, Berkeley.
And I've had a long-time interest in understanding fundamental biology, in particular aspects of genetic control and the way that evolution has come up with creative ways to regulate the expression of information in cells.
When you first literally heard the phrase CRISPR, just describe that moment, what your understanding of it was, and what you kind of initially envisioned it facilitating.
Well, when I first heard the acronym CRISPR, this was from a conversation with Jill Banfield, I had no idea what that was.
This was in 2006. Banfield, also a Berkeley scientist, had been studying bacteria that grow in toxic environments.
And so she was looking at bugs that grow in old mine shafts and, you know, these pools of water that build up in old mines that are often very acidic, or they have various kinds of metallic contaminants, to figure out what bugs are growing there and how are they surviving.
The key to their survival was called CRISPR. Clustered, regularly interspaced, short palindromic repeats.
Say that five times fast.
Banfield thought the bacteria had developed a sort of pattern-based immune system to protect themselves, but exactly how it worked was a puzzle. To help solve it, she recruited Doudna.
And we ended up spending several afternoons where Jill was showing me her DNA sequencing data from bacteria and, you know, explaining what these sequences were.
What began as a casual conversation about an obscure subject grew to consume Doudna for years. Finally, she had a breakthrough.
I suddenly just burst out laughing.
Today on Freakonomics Radio, the mind-blowing discovery that's already changing medicine and more.
A remarkable gene editing tool called CRISPR. That's right, I said gene editing.
The implications of that boundless change.
As I'm telling you this story, I feel this chill in my body.
And if you think the genetic revolution is still years away, you should think again.
The technology for that is here now.
From WNYC Studios, this is Freakonomics Radio, the show that explores the hidden side of everything. Here's your host, Stephen Dubner.
Congratulations on your future Nobel Prize. Jennifer Doudna hasn't won the Nobel Prize yet, but it's hard to imagine she won't. We'll go back to when she started working with Jill Banfield. Doudna learned that CRISPRs were DNA sequences stored in the cells of bacteria.
You can think about it like a genetic vaccination card. It's a way that cells store information in the form of DNA from viruses to use in the future to protect cells if that virus should show up again in the cell.
But how did it work? And what might it mean if scientists could figure it out? In 2011, having already studied CRISPR for a few years, Doudna attended a microbiology conference in Puerto Rico. There, she met Emmanuel Charpentier, then a researcher at Umeå University in Sweden. Charpentier was researching a mystery protein that she felt was the key to CRISPR. She and Doudna began a long-running collaboration.
We were working together to understand the molecular basis. In other words, what are the molecules that allow bacteria to find and destroy viral DNA? That was the question that we set out to address.
And in the course of that research?
And in the course of that research, we figured out that a particular protein, it has a name, Cas9, is programmable by the cell.
A protein that can be programmed to fight viruses? You can start to see where this is going.
The amazing thing that this Cas9 protein does is it works like a pair of scissors. It literally grabs onto the DNA and cuts it at that place, at that precise place.
They thought, if nature could program this Cas9 protein to precisely edit DNA, why couldn't they?
It turns out that when this is transplanted into animal or plant cells or human cells, it's possible to introduce changes to the DNA very precisely. And that's how the technology fundamentally works.
Then came the night at home cooking dinner for her son when she burst out in joyful laughter at the sheer wonder and the massive possibilities.
Isn't it crazy that nature has come up with this incredible little machine? So there was that sort of moment. And then, you know, I think that sort of morphed into a growing recognition that, you know, this technology was going to be very impactful in many different areas of science.
Doudna, together with Charpentier and several other colleagues, wrote up their research and on June 8th, 2012, formally submitted it to the journal Science. It was published 20 days later. Suddenly, the world knew that the CRISPR-Cas9 system could be harnessed as a new gene editing tool.
A new kind of genetic engineering is revolutionizing scientific research.
Scientists think CRISPR could launch a new era in biology and medicine.
CRISPR could help rid us of diseases like cystic fibrosis, muscular dystrophy, and even HIV and cancer.
Jennifer Doudna had spent her career largely cloistered in laboratories. She didn't have a high-profile background.
I grew up in a small town in Hawaii.
Suddenly, she was a scientific superhero.
We explore those questions with Jennifer Doudna.
Jennifer Doudna.
Jennifer Doudna.
Jennifer Doudna.
For harnessing an ancient bacterial immune system as a powerful gene editing technology.
The breakthrough prize is awarded to Emmanuel Charpentier and Jennifer Doudna.
Doudna has spent the past few years racing forward while also trying to slow things down. She wrestles with all this in a book she co-wrote with another CRISPR researcher, Samuel Sternberg. It's called A Crack in Creation. Why the title? It refers to what?
Well, at its core, the CRISPR gene editing technology is now giving human beings the opportunity to change the course of evolution. And, you know, human beings have been affecting evolution for a long time, right? But I think now there's a technology that allows very specific changes to be made to DNA that gives us a new level of control. And so, you know, it's sort of opening a crack, and I sort of see it as like analogous to opening a door to the future that is really, you know, a change in the way that we think about our world.
As opposed to like a crack in the dimension that we will fall through and all disappear. Not that kind of crack.
We hope the former, not the latter. Yeah.
Okay. All right. So as you write in the book, we uncovered the workings of an incredible molecular machine that could slice apart viral DNA with exquisite precision. So when you call it an incredible molecular machine, your breakthrough of you and your colleagues is essentially an external human-guided replica of what already exists, or are you kind of taking over the controls of what inherently exists?
This is important. We're really taking over the controls of what already exists. And we're doing it by using this bacterial system, the Cas9 protein, to find and make a cut in DNA in, let's say, human cells at a particular place where the cell's natural repair machinery can then take over and do the actual editing.
What's amazing to me is the natural repair machinery obviously exists, and maybe it works really well a lot of the time. It's just in the most drastic circumstances, like a cancer or a debilitating disease, it doesn't. Some things it catches, some things it doesn't. Sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't. So can you talk about the big picture of this repair mechanism and how well or poorly it does?
Sure. So DNA repair happens all the time in cells. And as you alluded to, it has to work right most of the time, or we would probably not be here, or we would all have a lot more cancer than we have. And so we know that cells experience double-stranded breaks to their DNA routinely, and that they have ways of fixing those breaks. And so I would say that what this CRISPR technology does is it really taps into that natural repair pathway.
Since the announcement of the CRISPR-Cas9 technology, scientists around the world have been exploring its possibilities in many different arenas. Let's start with plants.
I think it's important for people to appreciate that, you know, first of all, that humans have been modifying plants for a long time, you know, genetically. And, you know, literally thousands of years. Exactly. Thank goodness. Right. I mean, you realize, wow, I'm glad there's I'm glad there's plant breeding. But, you know, the way that that's been done traditionally is to use chemicals or even radiation to introduce genetic changes into seeds. And then plant breeders will select for plants that have traits that they want. And of course, you can imagine when you do something like that, you drag along a lot of traits that you probably don't want. And so I think the opportunity here with gene editing in plants is to be able to make changes precisely. So not to drag along traits that you don't want, but to be able to make changes that will be beneficial to plants, but to do that very precisely. And then we have the opportunity to do things like, you know, give plants the ability to grow with much less water or to defend themselves against various kinds of infections and, you know, pests that are moving in due to climate change. I think from the perspective of the world food supply, that's going to be extremely important going forward. And having a precision tool that allows us to generate plants that are better, let's say, adapted to particular environments or, you know, maybe have even better nutritional value. And I really believe that going forward that we can't afford to reject this. We really have to understand it and, you know, regulate it appropriately. But we do have to, I think we have to have this tool in our toolbox.
CRISPR gene editing is also being put to use on animals.
Scientists in China are engaged in controversial research genetically modifying beagles to be more muscular.
These mosquitoes have been genetically modified to breed with and eliminate their own species in an urgent attempt to wipe out carriers of dengue fever.
Researchers believe that they can recreate a woolly mammoth by combining its DNA with that of a modern elephant.
There's at least one and maybe more than one company now that are using the gene editing technology in animals, like in pigs, to create pigs that would be better organ donors for humans.
I like the micro pig, too.
Chinese Genomics Institute, BGI, began breeding micro pigs to study diseases. But now they're going to sell them as pets for $1,600 and give in to the micro pig craze. Miley Cyrus has one.
Yes, pets. Yeah. Right. The idea of, you know, sort of a fanciful use in a way of gene editing, you know, making animals that we think are cute.
The animal with the largest implications, of course, is the human. Coming up on Freakonomics Radio, how long until potential employers or mates are scouring our genetic profiles to see if we're worthy?
I mean, if you knew that your potential mate was at a high likelihood of developing early dementia, you might think twice before getting married.
And what keeps Jennifer Doudna up at night?
And I realized with this horror, you know, that I realized that it was Adolf Hitler.
From WNYC Studios, this is Freakonomics Radio. Here's your host, Stephen Dubner.
The gene editing revolution, prompted by the work of scientists like Jennifer Doudna, isn't the only gene-related revolution these days. Hey Dalton, it's Stephen Dubner. How's it going?
Hi, Stephen. How are you?
There's also social genomics.
The social genomics revolution is really just getting started, I would say.
Dalton Conley teaches sociology and population studies at Princeton.
And I'm the co-author of The Genome Factor.
So, Dalton, the subtitle of your book is What the Social Genomics Revolution Reveals About Ourselves, Our History, and the Future. Just begin by telling me, what do you mean by the social genomics revolution? What's revolutionary about it? And describe kind of the arc of the revolution and where we are in that.
Okay. Well, the social genomics revolution is really just getting started, I would say. When Bill Clinton stood up in the year 2000 and announced that the Book of Life had been decoded.
We are here to celebrate the completion of the first survey of the entire human genome. Without a doubt, this is the most important, most wondrous map ever produced by humankind.
Everyone thought everything was going to change suddenly. We were going to have personalized medicine. We were going to I don't know what.
It will revolutionize the diagnosis, prevention, and treatment of most, if not all, human diseases.
But actually, not much happened for the first decade or so.
The great scientific hope was to find single, easily identifiable genes that controlled cancer or depression or intelligence or even just height.
So that turns out to be an exception rather than a rule.
That's Jason Fletcher. He's an economist at the University of Wisconsin in Madison, and he's Conley's co-author on The Genome Factor.
Most of what we care about, most of life's important outcomes, are not one gene and one disease. They're more like hundreds or thousands of genes, all with really tiny effects, if you can even find them.
Having a map of the genome was one thing, but in the Bill Clinton era, there was a lack of good data. That has changed.
And now we have this, what I call the revolution, is this surfeit of cheap data, cheap genetic data.
Just 2 decades ago, it cost $1 billion to sequence a single genome. And now you and I could spit in a cup and send it to one of the popular sequencing outfits. And for $100 or for $150, we can get millions of answers to the question, what does our DNA look like?
Anyone who sends their saliva into 23andMe.
With just a small saliva sample, you'll learn about your ancestry through your 23 pairs of chromosomes and make you who you are.
To get their ancestry and their supposed health risks has now basically agreed to be part of their database that will be studied. And that has well over 1 million samples of mostly U.S. citizens.
And all that data is being pulled together in both genetic analysis and social science analysis to try to understand the vast array of outcomes we're all interested in. That's anything from Alzheimer's and dementia on the health side to measures of educational attainment and socioeconomic position on the social science side.
So we finally have big data sets with lots of genetic markers across the entire set of chromosomes, and we're now actually making robust discoveries that are withstanding replication and seem pretty solid. And I think that's the start of the revolution.
But warning, it's still early days.
That's right. So humans are very complicated, and the amount of data we're talking about is in the millions or tens of millions of locations on our genome.
So what does this mean for a technology like CRISPR gene editing?
I think that's going to be very exciting for a limited number of single gene diseases.
Diseases like cystic fibrosis and sickle cell disease and Huntington's disease.
But most things we care about in today's world, heart disease, Alzheimer's, IQ, height, body mass index, diabetes risk, all of those things are highly polygenic. That means that they're the sum total of many little effects all across chromosomes. And that probably means we're not going to be doing gene editing in 1,000 different locations in the genome.
At least not anytime soon. But with all the genomic data that are being accumulated, scientists have been devising a system to make sense of it all.
We have a tool that's emerged called the polygenic score.
So you take all the small effect sizes that you're finding across many, many, many genes, and you add them all up, and then you've created a summary scale of your predicted likelihood of doing X, where X could be smoking or getting dementia or going to college.
But those scores aren't predicting very well right now. So before anything drastic happened socially, I would think that those scores would need to get a lot better. Once they really start explaining a lot of the variation in society, then I would start worrying.
Worrying because why?
The use by external authorities and companies of this information, that's definitely scary. And I think the other dimension is going to be in the marriage market, where people just take it upon themselves to want to know genetic information about their potential mates. I mean, if you knew that your potential mate was at a high likelihood of developing early dementia, you might think twice before getting married. I mean, you know, phenotypes are for hookups, but genotype is forever. So the technology for that is here now. It could be used in fertility clinics. It could be used on dating apps where people could put their genetic profile linked from 23andMe to OkCupid.
Selection, of course, is something we all do every day. It's how we choose our friends, our allies and enemies, our political leaders. Some traits are observable, others less so. Some are heritable, others not. If the selection potential afforded by these new technologies is frightening to you, keep in mind The thing that's new about this is the technology. Remember the eugenics movement? That was justified by a preference for...
a preference for people of certain European ancestry, and not all European ancestry, but certain, just the favored groups, to have more children and to be given resources to the exclusion of all other people. And of course, it led pretty directly to Nazism and the exterminations of millions of people. And it also was used as the pseudoscience behind at least decades of racial injustice in the United States and many other countries.
That is the nightmare that has given Jennifer Doudna actual nightmares.
That really was one of the defining moments for me in terms of thinking about getting involved in the ethical conversation. So I had a dream in which I was working away. I think I was in my office, actually, and a colleague of mine came in and said, I'd like to introduce you to someone, and I would like you to explain the CRISPR technology to him. And he led me into a room, and there was a light in the room, and there was someone sitting in sort of a silhouette in a chair with his back to me. And he turned around, and I realized with this horror, and I can feel it right now as I'm telling you the story, I feel this chill in my body, you know, that I realized that it was Adolf Hitler. And he was looking at me with very, very intent look on his face and an eager kind of look, you know, and he wanted to know about this technology. And I felt this incredible sense of fear, both sort of personal fear, but also a profound kind of existential fear that, you know, if someone like that were to get a hold of a powerful technology like this, how would they deploy it? And of course, it, you know, when I woke up from that dream and I, you know, thinking about it subsequently, and it was really scary to think about. And I thought, you know, this, we have to proceed responsibly here. We cannot just, you know, I can't just carry on with my next experiment in my lab. I really have to get involved in a broader discussion about this. It's just too important a subject.
I don't mean to at all diminish your argument, but I hear a lot of scientists make a similar argument, which is, you know, look, we're doing our best on our end, and we really want to have this conversation kind of in public, especially with people who have the leverage, mostly politicians, let's say, to make smart choices. My question is, does a good mechanism or forum for that kind of conversation really exist?
Well, I think we're kind of building it as we're going at some level. I've been involved in organizing a number of meetings. They're right now, they're fairly small in focus, but the idea is to really answer, we hope, that question that you just posed is, how do you do that? How do you bring people from these different walks of life together so they can have a meaningful discussion? And I don't have the answer yet, but I do think that it has to involve formats that are accessible to people. It can't just be a bunch of academics,
right, talking in the silo to each other.
Right, exactly. It cannot be that. It has to be using various ways. I think the media are going to be very important. I think people that write science fiction are going to be important. I think that movie makers are going to be important. Musicians and various kinds of visual artists are going to be important. Because I think all of those people are very skillful at communication, communicating ideas, and they can do it in some ways much more effectively than, you know, a lot of technical jargon would ever achieve.
So probably the most enticing and certainly the most controversial aspect of CRISPR is the power to reshape human beings, whether an individual with an illness or a generation of a family or maybe an entire, you know, population. So obviously it's a gigantic area and something that probably nobody doesn't bring a lot of strong priors to the table with already. But can you just talk about this issue and your thinking about the issue and kind of where you've landed?
I've seen an evolution in my own thinking, quite frankly, you know, and I think that I sort of have gone from feeling very uncomfortable with, you know, sort of the idea of making changes to human embryos, especially for anything that would be considered, you know, not medically essential, to thinking that, you know, there may come a time, I don't think we're there now, and I don't think it's right around the corner, but I think there may come a time when that sort of application is embraced and is going to be deployed. And I think that for me, the important thing is not to reject it. It's actually to understand it and really think through the implications.
Now, let me ask you just to take a step back and talk about actual therapeutic, I guess, treatment and the difference between germline and somatic editing.
Ah, yes. So that's very important to understand the difference. So, most of the applications that we've been talking about, especially in medicine right now, involve what we call somatic cell editing. And that means making changes to the DNA in cells of a particular tissue in a person that's already fully developed. But those changes do not become heritable. They can't be passed on to the next generation. But the contrast to that is changes to the germline. And that means making changes to the DNA of embryos or eggs or sperm, changes that are inherited by future generations and become effectively permanent in the human genome. And so I think there's a profound difference between those two uses, because if you're doing something that affects one person, you know, it has to be regulated, of course, and you have to make sure that it's safe and effective, but it affects just that one person. Whereas if you make a change that affects somebody's, all of their children and all of their children's children, et cetera, that is really profound. And it really does affect, ultimately, human evolution.
And presumably, let's say I cared enough about some strain of heritability enough to do it, let's say on a fairly wide scale, then presumably it would increase my incentive to maybe diminish the supply of non-germline treated people, right? So you could
imagine... Now you're getting into Gattaca territory here.
Well, I mean, it doesn't take long, even for a mind as, kind of flabby as mine, to get there pretty quickly, right? I mean, the potential for this reminds me a bit of the potential for geoengineering, intentionally altering the planet's atmosphere to change the temperature in case global warming gets really destructive. So one of the key questions there is, governance. Who gets to control the thermostat? And I know you've been very outspoken in that you really flung yourself into the ethical and practical elements of this technology. But I'm curious where you stand on the kind of biggest... I don't want to say scariest, because I hate when we're knee-jerk scared of new technologies that are prima facie wonderful, but I do wonder your thinking on that.
Well, I think it's very important to, and you kind of alluded to this, but I think it's very important to emphasize that, this technology, I think, is going to, overall, it's going to have a very positive benefit to human beings in many ways. And I'd really like to make sure that people get that message, because, I think it's easy to, try to make things sound exciting by making them sound really scary.
Sure.
And I think this is a technology that really we're already seeing incredibly exciting advances, opportunities to cure genetic diseases that have had no treatments in the past, to advance the pace of clinical and other types of research, make it possible to understand the genetic basis for disease and then be able to do something about it when you have that information. So I think what needs to happen is that scientists need to really engage with government regulators and, frankly, also with religious leaders and other kinds of thought leaders to make sure, first and foremost, that there's a very clear understanding of the science behind this as much as possible.
Let's pretend that this technology within a couple generations works so beautifully that it extends lifespan by 20% or 50% or 200%. Do you think about what happens in terms of obvious things like, global resources if people are living twice as long, but also how we as animals would respond to that scenario in which scarcity diminishes so much, the scarcity being a short lifespan. It seems that humans are relatively slow to adapt to the diminishment of scarcity over time. Like, it seems we still eat, for instance, in the 21st century, as though the next meal may or may not appear on the horizon. So I'm curious if all of a sudden there are all these extra years in terms of everything, labor markets and retirement and existential issues, like what do I do now for those next 80 or 100 years that, Jennifer Doudna and her colleagues helped facilitate? Do you think about those things?
Well, there's lots of interest in that topic right now, as you know, especially here in Silicon Valley. I think for me, it really would come down to, are those extra years high quality years? And are they years where people could be contributing importantly to society? And if the answer is yes, then I think that is something that is very interesting to think about. If the answer is no, then I certainly don't think that sounds very appealing at all. I'd rather take short and healthy than long and miserable. But I think that the prospect of enhancing human health, if that goes hand in hand with longevity, I certainly would like to see it be something that was available to communities around the world, not just to a few people.
As much uncertainty as there is around the future of CRISPR-Cas9 and the genetic revolution generally, you probably won't be surprised to learn there's also uncertainty about where the proceeds from these discoveries will flow. As you can imagine, they are potentially huge. Jennifer Doudna's team filed patent rights early on to use the CRISPR system on virtually any living thing. But not long after, a researcher named Feng Zhang from the Broad Institute of MIT and Harvard filed CRISPR patents on an important subset of living things. The conflict went to the Federal Patent Trial and Appeal Board, which ruled in Zhang's favor. But the final outcome is far from settled. Coming up next on Freakonomics Radio, as it happens, Jennifer Doudna's field of biology includes a lot of female scientists. Other fields, not so much.
We need to go into our organizations and redesign how we hire, how we promote, how we evaluate people.
I think very small changes could be made that would have huge effects.
That's coming up next. And for more episodes like this one, check out our Freakonomics Radio archive on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen to podcasts, or at Freakonomics.com, where you'll also find our books, the blog, and much more.
From WNYC Studios, this is Freakonomics Radio. Here's your host, Stephen Dubner.
Okay, hello, Professor Strober.
Hello.
Hey, Stephen Dubner, how are you?
Fine, how are you?
Myra Strober was born in Brooklyn, 1941. She was a good student. She went to college at Cornell. At the time, only one in four undergraduates at Cornell were women. Strober was planning to become a school teacher, but then she was offered a graduate school fellowship. Her two areas of interest were economics and history.
I thought historians had to know everything about everyone anytime, and so I thought economics would be a little easier.
She studied economics at Tufts and then at MIT. In the economics PhD program at MIT, women were even scarcer than they'd been in undergrad.
I was completely shocked at how male my program was.
So male that when she walked into the first day of her labor econ class,
the professor said, "I think you're in the wrong room, young woman." And I looked him square in the eye and said, "I don't think so. I'm Myra Strober."
Strober got her PhD in economics from MIT and later became an assistant professor at the University of Maryland. She'd gotten married, and her husband was offered a tenure-track job as a professor of medicine at Stanford in Palo Alto, California. So they moved to California. By now, they had two young children. Strober got a teaching job at Berkeley, about 40 miles north of Palo Alto, but she was hired as a lecturer, not an assistant professor, which is what she'd been at Maryland.
The very first day I was at Berkeley, I saw that two of my classmates from MIT were assistant professors at Berkeley.
That is, two male classmates from MIT.
And so I made an appointment with the chair of the economics department, George Brake, to find out why I was a lecturer and they were assistant professors. He told me that the reason was that I lived in Palo Alto.
Meaning 40 miles away.
And I was astonished. But I believed him, you know, that was the reason.
So she left his office
and got into my car to drive back to Palo Alto from Berkeley.
The route took her over the Bay Bridge.
And on that bridge, I realized that his answer was absolutely ridiculous and that, in fact, there was only one other woman in the economics department at Berkeley. She'd been there for 20 years, and she was still a lecturer. And I always say I became a feminist on the Bay Bridge.
It It took a while, but Strober got a second meeting with her department chair.
First, he asked me if I would like him to be frank, and I said, yes, I would. And so he told me that I had two young children, and they couldn't give me an assistant professor position because they didn't know, quote, what was going to happen to me. I don't know what he thought would happen to me, but I said, well, why don't you put me on the tenure track, and in 6 years, we'll all see what happens to me. And he said, I could never sell that to the department.
Strober wound up leaving Berkeley. In 1972, she became the first female faculty member at Stanford's Graduate School of Business.
And then the advisory board told the dean that they needed to hire women, and they couldn't find any because none had been trained. And they urged the business school to start admitting more women.
There were only 5 female students in the business school out of a few hundred.
So the business school recruited women for 1 year, and I helped with that. And that was the end of the recruiting, because as soon as women knew that the business school, this was not just at Stanford, this was nationwide. As soon as they knew that business schools wanted to enroll women, they applied in droves.
Think about that. As soon as women knew the business schools wanted to enroll women, they applied in droves. Is it really that easy? What if many of the gender barriers we're staring down lately are as flimsy as that? The economist Myra Strober has written a book called Sharing the Work, What My Family and Career Taught Me About Breaking Through and Holding the Door Open for Others.
I am a professor emerita at Stanford University. I am still teaching a course there on work and family.
Her book is part memoir, part analysis of how the workplace has always been and probably always will be a different kind of challenge for men and women. This fact has come up constantly for Strober, and it led her to ask a simple question.
How is it and why is it that men are the majority in certain occupations, the more lucrative ones, and women are the majority in others? Why is it that there's so much occupational segregation?
Occupational segregation is a major driver of the gender pay gap. You've probably heard the famous statistic that women earn roughly 77 cents for every dollar that men earn for doing the same work. It's also a famously flawed statistic, as we discussed in an earlier episode that was called The True Story of the Gender Pay Gap. And it features research done by the Harvard economist Claudia Golden.
Well, it is true that if you took individuals in the labor force and took those who are working full-time, full year, and took all women, took the median annual earnings of those women, and took the same thing for men, and divided the two, it would be 0.77, or around that, okay? So does that mean that women are receiving lower pay for equal work? That is possibly the case in certain places, but by and large, it's not that, it's something else.
One component of that something else is occupational sorting, or as Myra Strober calls it, occupational segregation. It was her own experience as the rare female economist that got her thinking about this.
And I came across this notion that men had monopolized the lucrative professions.
So, her big research question?
After studying occupations that change their gender designation, like bank telling and elementary school teaching, I realized that although people talk about occupations becoming feminized, that is, women taking them over, really what's going on is that men are leaving occupations which are no longer relatively attractive in terms of salary, working conditions, and promotion opportunities.
Why did men, historically at least, get first dibs on the best-paying jobs?
I think the answer is that society, and I think this is still true, thinks that men are the supporters of their families. And so it makes sense to give them the best jobs because they need to earn what used to be called a family wage. They need to earn enough to support a family. Whereas a woman either needs to earn nothing because the man is supporting her, or she needs to simply support herself. And so once a job is designated as male or female, it's very hard to change that designation.
Do you think there was willful either discrimination or exclusion in order to protect wages and privilege and so on that males had? Or was it more like it took way too long for the feminization of the workforce to happen, but not necessarily because of ill will?
I think it was a combination of both. I think that, for example, in medicine, medical schools had a quota and simply did not admit more than a few women in any year. I think that when an employer or an industry group is thinking about hiring women into jobs that have been previously all male, they have to be a little innovative. I think you could get more young women interested in engineering if you discuss the ways in which engineers help people in society. Women like to help people in society. Well, engineers, by and large, do that. But that's not the way that engineering is sold. And so I think very small changes could be made that would have huge effects.
Small changes having huge effects. That is a favorite theme of ours around here. It describes a lot of what behavioral economics tries to do.
Okay. Well, thank you for having me. I'm Iris Bonnet.
Thanks for joining us.
I'm a professor of public policy at the Harvard Kennedy School, and I'm an economist by training.
Anything else?
And I also direct the Women in Public Policy program.
Anything else?
I co-chair the Behavioral Insights Group, and that's a group that focuses on better understanding behavioral insights, the mechanisms that help us make better decisions in organizations and in society more broadly.
Anything else?
I'm the author of What Works? Gender Equality by Design, which brings these insights to bear on the question of gender equality.
The focus of the book?
The book focuses on what organizations can do, including schools, but then companies, agencies, governments can do to close gender gaps using behavioral insights.
Bonnet, like many smart people, believes that you can't solve a problem until you understand its root causes. So when you consider gender gaps in the labor market, whether it's wages or occupational segregation or opportunity, what are some of the factors that drive these gaps? Let's start with something that's hard to quantify, our perception of competence and how that perception may differ from women to men. So tell me about Heidi Roizen and her fictional twin brother, Howard.
Heidi Roizen is a venture capitalist in Silicon Valley and an entrepreneur and a very successful businesswoman. And a few years ago, Kathleen McGinn and a team of collaborators wrote a case about Heidi. It's the kind of case that people who are in a graduate school would be confronted with when they study business, for example, or public policy. And the case talks about Heidi and, you know, what she did to create her network in Silicon Valley and how she built her enterprises. And then a few years later, a few colleagues of ours, in fact, two men at Columbia Business School, replaced Heidi's name with Howard. They gave half of their students the case with the protagonist being called Heidi, and the other half with the protagonist being called Howard.
And I'm assuming they're randomizing, and I'm assuming that the other half doesn't know what the other half is getting, correct?
That's exactly right. What we typically find is that when we ask our students to evaluate Heidi and Howard after they have done the case, people, and I specifically say people, so this is not just men, but men and women, will say that Heidi and Howard both did a good job, were competent, they perform well, but they don't like Heidi. And they don't like Heidi because Heidi defies the stereotypes that we have about what a typical venture capitalist looks like, but also what a typical woman does.
But they only don't like it when they know or think that she is a woman. If they know or think that she's a man, then she's considered, what, a kind of maverick who, good for him slash her, he-she got where he-she wanted to get by breaking the rules? Is that the idea?
They didn't quite break the rules, but by being assertive. So yes, so competence and assertiveness and success and leadership go together for men, but they don't go together for women.
Right. So why do you suspect this is the case, especially because it's the case not only for male students assessing him slash her, but female students as well?
Seeing is believing. And there's tons of evidence suggesting that what we see or who we see, more importantly, is more important than who we are ourselves.
But it's not just what you see. It's also how you hear. For instance, I happen to be male, which means that when I say something, regardless of what I say and how I say it, it will be received differently than if my non-existent female twin,
male
Stephanie
twin
Dubner,
Stephen Dubner,
were to,
were
say,
to say
the very same thing.
Okay. I'm Megan Sumner.
And she is?
I'm an associate professor of linguistics at Stanford University.
Which means what, exactly?
I'm a phonetician, and my research focuses on how we understand spoken language. So what's uttered, and who has spoken something, and how we integrate that information.
For instance, how do we perceive the same words spoken by a woman versus a man? Sumner and her colleague Ed King recorded a man's voice and a woman's voice saying the same word. For instance,
academy.
Academy.
She then asked listeners of both genders to immediately say the next word that came to mind.
When participants would hear a word spoken by a man,
like academy,
the first word that pops into their mind,
and this held true for female and male listeners,
would be
school.
But when they heard the same word spoken by a woman,
academy,
the first word that pops into their mind would be
award.
So when a man says the word academy, the top associate is school. But when a female says the word academy, the top associate is award.
The idea, Sumner argues, is that our unconscious stereotyping influences how we listen. And both male and female listeners are apparently more likely to anticipate a woman talking about Hollywood than, say, a school. Now, if you broaden that out, it means that we are processing language differently based on whether a woman or man is doing the speaking. Megan Sumner and her colleagues did another experiment looking at our absolute and then our relative rankings of male and female speakers.
So a man's voice that's rated as not so reliable on its own is rated as more reliable in the context of a woman's voice, so it gets a kind of boost. And a woman's voice that's rated as reasonably reliable alone gets downgraded as less reliable in the context of a man's voice.
And you can imagine how that would penalize women in just about any setting.
I think this has huge implications just for how we interact and the types of information that we're using to make decisions on an everyday basis.
Consider a job interview. You're the person doing the hiring. Here's what Sumner's research suggests. Let's say you interview a man for the job, and you think he's only so-so. Then you interview a woman for the job. Suddenly, the man seems, in retrospect, a better candidate than he seemed before you interviewed the woman. And that, says the economist Iris Bonnet, is why
interviews are probably the most overvalued instrument at our disposal.
It's another of those societal constructs that may be putting women at a disadvantage.
It turns out, quite literally hundreds of studies have shown that interviews do a very bad job predicting future performance. So it's not that nothing useful happens in an interview, but it's almost impossible for our minds to sift through what we've just learned and tease apart the valuable information from the less valuable information.
So what's the solution? Do we change the way women speak? That's not what Megan Sumner wants, even though her own research points out the problem.
It's kind of made me grumpy, quite honestly, because our voice and the way we talk is something about ourselves, and we're conveying who we are along with what we say. And so I kind of had this feeling of, gosh, now maybe people are going to try to change how they talk, and that would be sad. I think we have to change how we listen.
Iris Bonnet agrees. She also thinks that leaning in, the idea that women just need to ask for more in the workplace, isn't such a great solution. It goes back to the Heidi Howard experiment, which found that men and women found an assertive female entrepreneur less likable than a fictional male version of the same person.
It's very important that we talk about the evidence that it is harder for women to lean in than for men because they violate gender norms. Women are penalized for being assertive because assertiveness is not traditionally associated with women while it is with men. And in men, we applaud it and think that makes for a good leader. And in women, we think it is trying to find a better word than the B word. I'm not going to say the B word here, but
we know the word you're thinking.
We know
yeah.
what I mean. Yeah. So we don't have warm thoughts about assertive women, but we might call it aggressiveness. Let's call it aggressiveness instead of assertiveness. And women need to know that that is a risk that is real.
Right. So rather than wait around for the 200 or maybe 2 million years for assertiveness, let's say, to be associated with women, because it sounds from what you're saying that there's no guarantee that that construct will change at least anytime soon. Rather than wait around for that and acknowledging that people have biases that are hard to erase, what do you do? What are the answers? What are the solutions?
So we need to go into our organizations and redesign how we hire, how we promote, how we evaluate people. I think there's a number of things we can do. Most immediately, we can move from an unstructured interview protocol to a structured interview protocol. And that means we think about the questions beforehand, we write down the questions beforehand. Ideally, in the best of all worlds, we then measure which questions do a good job predicting future performance. But at the very least, we think hard about which questions we think would do a good job. And then we ask these five questions in the same order, and we ask the same questions whenever we interact with a candidate.
Bonnet also suggests that firms do away with employees' self-evaluations since they can be skewed by gender. Another suggestion addresses the idea that women are sometimes not seen as wanting success as much as men.
Many organizations evaluate people who are up for promotion based on past performance and future potential. And the bias tends to kick in terms of potential for two reasons. A, it's much harder to measure than performance. And B, of course, potential goes back to the Heidi Howard problem where we can't imagine that women would like to want to climb up the career ladder and therefore we think she has less potential. So try to break down potential into its subcomponents and be very honest with yourself on what you're actually trying to measure with potential.
A lot of these changes seem, no offense, really easy. I mean, pretty simple to build. If they are so easy, why do you think that many of them haven't been used more?
So first of all, I don't take offense at all. In fact, one of the big arguments of the book is that these are low-hanging fruit, often relatively cheap, and we should do them tomorrow. So a number, you know, here's a number of potential culprits. Now, I don't think I have evidence to tell us, you know, which one it is. But there's this interesting thing going on that we tend to rely on evidence and data in our finance departments and even in our marketing departments, where we often even run experiments, real scientific methods to understand, you know, whether Diet Coke or Pepsi Max works for men and women respectively, for example. And we haven't used those same methods in our HR departments. I don't know exactly where that comes from, why we haven't used the same kind of rigor and scrutiny when we think about people. In many ways, we should be even more careful when we make people decisions compared to product decisions. But there seems to be this last bastion in many ways in HR that honestly I think is going to change dramatically with the new data, big data, the new technologies, machine learning that we have available now in the next 10 years. We just haven't used the same tools that we have used in other parts of our organizations so far.
That may be true. We may be entering an era in which more firms use more data to understand how to get the most out of their employees and how to make their employees happier and more productive. But there's also this. Human nature being what it is, a bundle of cognitive biases and adherence to social norms, you can't solve every problem according to logic. Sometimes you need to design a solution that factors in all these biases and norms.
I think we have to take human psychology seriously and meet people where they're at and not ask for the impossible.
I'm Stephen Dubner, and that was Freakonomics Radio. Thanks for listening. We will be back next week. You can find our entire Freakonomics Radio podcast archive at freakonomics.com or at Apple Podcasts, where you can also subscribe.